Welcome to Season 5 of the Prosthetics and Orthotics Podcast with Joris Peels and Brent Wright. We're bringing in industry experts, patients, vendors, and thought leaders to share their stories, insights, and visions for the future. Whether you're a clinician, a researcher, a vendor, or someone with a personal interest in the field, we have something for you. Join us as we delve into how advancements in personalized healthcare and 3D printing are revolutionizing the industry and changing the way we approach the design, production, and delivery of prosthetic and orthotic devices.
Hello, everyone. My name is Joris Peels, and this is another edition of the Prosthetic and Orthotics Podcast with Brent Wright. How are you doing, Brent?
Oh, man, doing well. I'm really excited about today's guest, but I'm also excited about our sponsors that sponsor this episode.
Who is our sponsor, Brent?
So our title sponsor, I would say, is Advanced 3D. The neat thing about Advanced 3D is I'm a part of that. It's something that I am really excited about moving forward with. And we're a contract manufacturer for specifically for prosthetics and orthotics, but we do a whole bunch of other things. And the whole idea is to really come alongside of anybody that's looking at the technology and really being their guide, meeting them wherever they are, if they're looking at software, if they're looking at 3D printers, if they want to print, whatever it is, we want to help them and really just advance this kind of initiative of 3D printing and O&P going forward. And we want to help as many people as we can, not only here in the U.S., but really worldwide. And that's what kind of anchors our passion is. We believe that 3D printing will create access to those that would otherwise not have access to a prosthesis.
Okay. That sounds wonderful. This is one. And so one of the things you do, so you can help me with my design, or you could help me invent something, or you can help me develop something.
That's right. A lot of people will say, hey, Brent, I've got this idea and I have this thing that's cobbled together with, you know, toothpicks and a glue stick and, you know, hot glue and all that. Can you make it for us? And we can absolutely, you know, create it and get it ready for 3D printing or other sort of fabrication if you need it.
Okay, sounds really cool. And are any particular technologies you're using or kind of printers you have, that kind of thing?
We have a production multi-jet fusion printer from Hewlett-Packard. We also run the multi-jet fusion 580, which is a full color printer. And we run nylon 11, nylon 12, and TPU.
Super cool. And thank you, Brent, for sponsoring us.
Yeah, kind of crazy. Well, there's three of us that make up Advanced 3D. So it's Paul, Tyler, and myself. And we've had them on the show. But yeah, we had to clear it with everybody, but they were like, let's do this.
Okay. All right. And so who's on our podcast today?
Oh, man, I'm really excited today. And I can't believe it. It's been 50 episodes, Joris. That's wow. Isn't that nuts?
That's crazy. I hope we get here. I didn't know if we would, but I hope so.
So today I reached out to Dr. David Boone, and he's kind of one of the originals in the field when it comes to digitization. And one interesting thing, he's one of just a handful of prosthetists and orthotists that actually has a PhD in prosthetics and orthotics. He has a PhD also in biomechanics from the Hong Kong Polytechnic University. He has over 40 journal articles, an inventor on 13 different issued patents, and he was part of the kind of the initial commercialized version of CAD/CAM for O&P with a company called Shape Maker. But I think what's neat, and you know, I haven't talked to him a lot. This will be the first time that I've talked, but from everything that I've seen, he is very much a collaborator, and he wants everybody to be better in the field of O&P. He's very encouraging to others. And, you know, you can read a resume, but it's really what they do. And so I think that's one of the neat things that I see about Dr. Boone here is that he really wants to raise the water level for everybody and everybody get better. So I'm excited to have him on.
All right. That's a super cool, super good. Awesome guest you found for 50th episode as well. Really amazing. So David, thank you for being on our podcast.
Oh, my pleasure, guys.
And so how'd you get involved with OMP? How'd you end up, you know, picking this as your area to work in?
Well, I'm like Brent, I didn't grow up in it. I kind of backed my way in, I guess, 1981, 82. I was a bioengineering student at the University of Washington in Seattle. And I took a year off to study in France. And this was an era of higher education budget cuts that were pretty draconian. And while I was gone in France, the whole undergraduate bioengineering department was eliminated under the federal budget cuts at the time. So I came back and really needed to figure out, well, what am I going to graduate in now? And so in 83, I looked at it. And one of the things in my, you know, starting off at the university, I'd done some student projects with a quadriplegic man working on a language board that's part of an engineering project. And I found that I enjoyed working with that client a lot. And so I started thinking about something more clinical. And it just happened to be that at the University of Washington, we had one of the few P&O degree programs at the time. So I had a lot of prerequisites. I looked at it. It was like clinical engineering to me. And so I applied and got into the P&O program, graduated, and have really had a great career since, all in P&O.
Okay, okay. And what keeps you interested? Is it that human contact or the fact that you're kind of like engineering for people, or what keeps you interested in this?
Yeah, I mean, that's the part that is super exciting, you know, every day. I remember the very first transtibial prosthesis I made in school really got me hooked. I, you know, like any new student, I really didn't know what I was doing, and I did my best to make this prosthetic socket and set it up for alignment. And I remember I had forgotten in the patient exam room, I'd forgotten to bring a foot bolt wrench. So I excused myself from the patient, and I ran down to my workbench and grabbed a wrench. And when I got back to the exam room, the patient was gone, and I was just crestfallen. I was like, okay, I failed my very first thing. And so I opened the door, and I looked down the hall, and here was this brand new patient, never had a prosthesis before, walking back down the hall in the prosthesis I'd made, because he had to go to the bathroom. And so that was with, it was such a pivotal moment for me. I thought, now you'll never do anything cooler in your life, and so you better stick with this. So, yeah, that's the excitement. That's what keeps me in it. As Brent said, you know, I really like the idea now, later in my career, about just improving the field itself. But it all comes back just to that patient, like that first one that walked away on me unexpectedly.
Okay. Okay. Do you have a solution now? Do you have them go to the bathroom before or tie them down or something?
Yeah. No. You know, I probably should have failed that anyway, since I let him out of my control and hadn't checked out the prosthesis yet. But live and learn. I didn't hurt him, and I found actually that most of my patients have been far more obedient than that.
Okay. But, and so one thing we've had a lot of practitioners on and clinician people and all this, but we haven't had that many like academic people. What's the academic field like for orthotics and prosthetics?
Well, when I started, it was very nascent. There were like three of us with PhDs when I got mine. There wasn't a really strong academic pursuit other than the clinical training. But I've spent almost all my career in research. I was very fortunate. When I graduated, I got a job offer at University College London at the Roehampton Limbfitting Center in London. And they had one of the nascent CAD-CAM development programs going on. And so I was hired to be the research prosthetist for that right out of school.
Wow. And is it, okay, is this, because we've heard people say stuff like, and I did a project at one point in orthotics, and then people were just like, yeah, it feels a bit stiff. We need to kind of like make it a little bit looser or something. And I was like, just like, what are these people talking about? It just seems like they're playing it all by ear. Is that true still, that people are just still kind of, you know, rather than being more engineering about things, that people are still like seeing themselves as artisans more like it?
Well, yeah, you know, that's a fair statement, because of the human machine interface is super complex. It's very hard to predict. It's very hard to model. There are a few places you can. One of the things we've learned over the past 30 years, for instance, is that you can biomechanically model prosthetic and orthotic alignment really easily, really well. Now, people still do it by the seat of their pants, because clinical practice is very slow to change. And that's just because people tend to fall onto what works for them, what they've learned, what they've gotten used to. But we could change and make all orthotic and prosthetic alignment instrumented and optimized today. That we've done. Shape is a little bit different. You know, shape relates to loading of the limb and comfort on the limb, and how efficient you are. It's such a complex interaction, like I said, between the person and the machine, that it's not so clearly delineated even now. And lots and lots of research has been done, you know, in the last 30 years, from Tom Kruskoff in Texas in the 80s up to, I see, almost exactly the same experiments being done by graduate students now. No one's really sort of cracked the shape model, you know, how you get to the optimum shape for fitting someone.
Okay, and that sounds doable. Why is that so hard? Just because everybody is unique? Is it that simple? There's different levels of tissue involved? Why is that hard?
Well, no, it's even more complex than that. So generally, engineers will look at it and say, well, we'll define the tissues, the densities, the geometries. We can map all that out. But the real difference is that the individual patient that you're fitting will moderate, though, what we call, they'll adjust their dosage of forces dynamically by changing their balance, shifting weight to the other leg, changing how long they hold their stance phase. So there's this interaction of active control and overriding what you assume is going to happen mechanically by the brain of the patient. And that's what makes it so complex.
So along that, I mean, it sounds like with the parameters of the alignment, and I do want you to get into that a little bit as how it relates to osteointegration, as we see a lot of that coming in. But it sounds as though if some of that alignment stuff was standardized, that would take out one of the variables when creating the sockets, right? Because it seems like prosthetists, it's a dance, but really it shouldn't be a dance, because the alignment is a known thing.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Brett, that you could take away a huge part of the variability in how the socket's going to be loaded if you controlled the alignment. And that's actually an area that I'm still pushing, have been for the last, you know, 10 years, is better understanding, better teaching, and better instrumentation to help prosthetists and orthotists too standardize their alignment.
Can you speak a little bit to if and how it's being used in osteointegration, the alignment stuff that you're talking about?
Yeah, so osteointegration, of course, eliminates the socket problem, the fit. Then it's really more about the efficiency of gait and also the loading on the implant. So in one instance, people are very interested in how much the osseointegrated implant in the bone is being loaded and whether or not that's going to be building up bone or is it going to be tearing down bone? Because you want the bone strength to increase. Now, in general, if you keep it under a certain level, you're going to build bone. This is something we've known for a long time with Wolf's Law, that if you're loading bone, then as long as the cellular biology is intact, then it'll build up strength. And then same with osseointegrated implants, that you should end up with a strong interface if you're not overloading it. Now, the other part is efficiency of gait. So this is, I think it's really, for prosthetists, they tend to realize this is the case with transfemoral prosthetics more than transtibial, but it's the same in both. In transfemoral prosthetics, the alignment directly affects the stability of the knee dynamically. And that stability is what drives how efficient your gait is. So one way to think about it is that in a perfectly efficient system, the amputee basically puts zero impulse into their hip flexion to get the leg moving in swing phase. And the instant that the knee is stable and fully extended, they touch the ground at heel contact. And if all that is balanced perfectly, then it takes very little energy. It's very smooth and there's no noise. That's a perfectly aligned transfemoral prosthesis. Same thing happens with transtibial, though, because we have our knee intact, it's more forgiving. And so the same also holds true for osseointegrated prostheses. You want that efficiency because you have such control, direct control of the prosthesis, both in proprioception and in physical control because of the direct skeletal attachment. We tend to not optimize quite enough. In other words, the amputee has so much control with osseointegrated implant, you can do a less than optimal job of the alignment, and they can adjust to it. One of my mantras is, for everything that our lab does in research, is, the amputee should never have to accommodate the prosthesis. We should be adjusting to the needs of the patient. And that's where the advancement prosthetics and orthotics needs to go, is to be less of a hindrance and more of a help all the time.
Wow. I like that a lot. Let's say if we took the alignment, if everybody in a perfect world had the alignment jig, can you give us a sense of what your perfect transfemoral and transtibial socket theory would be for patients?
Okay, sure. If we're talking about a socket, I think that the perfect one would, first of all, breathe. I'm not a great fan of completely sealing the surface of the skin. So, we've gone to silicone liners to a great degree because of its ability to conform to the load situation and be forgiving. But it's completely sealed, and that's not very physiological. So that'd be one of the first things I'd say. It'd be the ideal thing would be something that conformed and gave you the same sort of adaptation to different loading conditions, which silicone does, but breathe. One of the things I've imagined is something more like a woven silicone sock or a 3D structure that's porous enough to breathe rather than a solid gel. So that would be the first step of the interface. So you've got something a little bit compliant, but probably a little bit more rigid than we think. So I don't think that the ideal interface is something super soft and squishy. I think the ideal interface is probably something very close to how firm your muscle gets when it's firing. So if you imagine your calf muscle firing in the socket, it's a pretty firm structure when the muscle's contracted. And I believe that the optimal transfer of force is going to be where the interface is about that same firmness. So now I've put a couple constraints on it. Well, it should be porous and breathable, and it should be firmer, not squishier. And then ideally, you know, there are diurnal or daily changes in volume, which are pretty significant, a couple percent anyway, for everybody. We've adjusted that through addition and subtraction of layers of material, like socks, prosthetic socks outside of liners or just at the interface. I think the ideal socket should be in equilibrium. In other words, that the overall supporting pressure in the socket should drive its volume to equalize throughout the day, so that people aren't having to adjust. Again, that premise of we should adapt to the needs of the user and not force them to adapt to the limits of the prosthesis. So something adaptive in volume is another element of that interface. The shape of it is really complex. We have some guidelines that have worked over the years where we say, well, we want to not have even loading because not all areas of the amputated limb are equally suited to load. You know, bony prominences, for instance, bursa, for instance. So we have this idea that, well, it shouldn't be equal all over. There should be some distribution of force, which is unequal. That unequal distribution, ideally, I think, should also be dynamic, because it's going to be different if you are in a seated static position, which amputees are typically 60, 65% of their day. You don't want to keep pressing or loading tissue for a long period of time like that. So that's a different situation. But when you're walking or jogging or running, each of those, you're applying loads in a different way. Jogging, you have more vertical load. Running, you're pushing off more to accelerate. And so it seems like that distribution should also change. So volume should change now. Well, the distribution of load should be adaptive too in the ideal socket. Now, have we gotten to all of these? No. People have addressed little bits of this problem at a time, but never really holistically. We don't have the ideal prosthetic socket for any level. But there are some sort of engineering constraints or thoughts that I think we should be considering when we're designing interfaces.
That's so cool. Yeah, I love that. And I love the idea of whiteboarding those constraints and trying to design about around that. And this just actually happened recently in yours. And David, you'll get a kick out of this. So I had done a prosthesis for a young man, bilateral, also missing both of his arms as well. And he was in silicone liners and that sort of thing. And I'm not the main prosthetist, is somewhere else. And we had done these beautifully 3D printed sockets with latticed liners, but he was still using the silicone. And the prosthetist was like, "Hey, Brent, I love how you did the cushion and the patient really loves it, but we're going to take the liners out of the equation. And I want you to flip the lattice to the inside and he's going to go skin fit." He was a Nidus articulation, skin fit all the way down, because he feels like the lattice will breathe and provide him enough cushion. And it worked.
Well, and I'm really glad to hear that, Brad.
And so, but all that to say is we have to sometimes step back and listen and take a collaborative effort of people. You know, I have the design ability, but I don't necessarily have the vision of and the gumption to actually try something, and then the patient also wanting to be a part of that whole thing too. So I think there are some things, especially in the additive manufacturing realm, that just sometimes it's going to be a happy accident. You know, it doesn't always go that way, but there are a few aha moments as well. So that'll be something that we'll be digging into a little bit.
Okay. Yeah, that's super exciting, actually. You're right. New processes like additive manufacturing. It shouldn't just replace structures as they've been. There's new opportunities for changing. I'm glad to hear that you'd made that, you know, leap of faith to follow the opportunity there.
All right, we're going to pause right there just for a moment. We have a new segment called the O&P News Flash. It's your go-to source for quick updates and highlights in the world of orthotics and prosthetics. I'm really excited for Just Podo to be sponsoring specifically this news section. And I think one of the neat things about Just Podo is I think they're onto something as far as automation within the specifically foot orthoses and then coming soon AFOs. And right now, their foot orthosis module is actually one of the most powerful things that I've seen. Literally, you can do a foot orthosis from start to finish in just a matter of minutes, if even that.
Okay, and that's you paid for that, right? You're actually a paying customer, right?
That's absolutely right. If you pry money out of my hands for your software, you are on to something. And so, yes, we are a paying customer of Just Podo, and we look forward to seeing what comes as they grow.
So, Brent, what's the news in O&P we want to talk about?
Well, yeah, I've been kind of looking at what is significant, and I came across this that I think is very significant. It appears as though O&P Labs, which is based in Springfield, Northampton, and Pittsburgh, Massachusetts, got acquired by the Ortho Dev America Group, or corporation. And they have ties to a group called Equal. And I'm trying to dive into what that means for O&P. But this group, Equal, is on a tear as far as acquisitions. And this seems to be an interesting addition to their portfolio, along with a couple other notable ones, such as Rodin, Avorum, and TechMed in the 3D space. And so not only are they really investing in technology and manufacturing, but they're also investing in clinical practices as well. And I think they're going to give some of the kind of mainstay stakeholders, the Osers, Autobox, Hangers of the world, a real run for their money.
Okay. So this is to me, it's very interesting. We keep talking about this consolidation in the market, right? These big companies, big capital coming in and kind of they're doing the McDonaldization of orthotics and prosthetics. This is something that we've talked about a whole bunch of things. Do you think that's the case? That someone's just going to try to say, hey, you know what? There's all these mom and pop guys. Let's bring in some money and blow them all away. Or is that happening? Or
from what I can see, what I can tell, this is how do we scale and control our own verticals? And that's what it's really going to come down to is, especially in the U.S. market, you know what you're going to get paid for when you get a specific device. So the only way to be more profitable is to pay less for it on the front end. And then the way that you pay less on it is you actually own that vertical, whether it be manufacturing, billing, fabrication of something. But if you own that vertical, the spread or the profitability does increase, and it makes it more and more difficult for some of these mom and pops to compete effectively. But it also provides a massive opportunity for these mom and pops too, because as you said, you know, we always say tongue in cheek, the McDonaldification of O&P, but also they say the Starbucks of O&P or what have you, is not everybody fits in that model as far as patients go. And so if you have great patient care, I think there's always a place for you. But I really think it's what is interesting about this group, the Equal Group, seems to be looking at the orthotic and prosthetic industry in a different set of lenses compared to some of the quote-unquote competitors. And they've made some very strong acquisitions.
Okay. I think this could go either way. I mean, I think it could bring a higher level of care because people have to. But I think the careful thing, I think that is something that's notable you're pointing out, is this whole idea of if they make all the tools and all the materials, if they start compounding their own plastic, if they start doing more central fabrication, if they start doing central fabrication outside the country, that kind of thing, there's very little way to join back or to fight back against that. I think that's a really, really very valid point. And we are seeing, but, you know, to me as well, it could be really good to have more bigger players kind of, you know, out innovating each other. That could be a really, really advantageous thing if that could be as a result of this.
100% and absolutely agree. But, you know, for our listeners out there, definitely check out what's going on with the Equal Group. And we'd love to hear your feedback. And shoot us a message or what have you. And if you have any notable news, hey, it might make it into the next segment. So give us a shout as well. Thanks for listening to the Orthotic and Prosthetic News Flash. Let's get back to our guest.
Yeah, what's interesting, by the way, as an aside, is that there's a company called Carbon, and they have these ladder structures, and they put them on the back of backpacks, right? And they're printed with VAT polymerization, right? And that doesn't breathe well either. But in a ladder structure in a backpack, they can apply them in different zones and also have different load zones, right? And also have like a zonal kind of cooling element as well. So in a backpack, it's kind of a very similar kind of thing, even but less intense, of course. But that also works. So that's also a really interesting thing to look at going forward.
Yeah, that's really, really exciting. You know, we've been, some of us have been really hopeful for that kind of development. And for a long, long time, you know, the first CAD program I put together for doing socket shapes was winter of 85. So now we're almost talking 40 years. And we're still trying to figure out the shape.
Yeah, that's crazy. So now we see if CAD, for example, you talked specifically about CAD 40 years ago, it must have been horrendous, by the way, right? It must have been like loading all day, that kind of thing, or something like that. You make one change, you have to go.
Honestly, I just was still today, I come across active copies of ShapeMaker being used. That particular program we released in 1991. And you know, the thing that we did that was really, I think that gave it legs was we spent a lot of time on that 3D to 2D transformation for the screen. And the first thing we had to write our own 3D graphics library at the time, and it was super effective. And even today, you know, that 30-year-old software is still chugging away on people's computers.
And do you think that software, or what's been the biggest leap in software? Do you still think that there's a lot more to be done, or in CAD to make CAD more accessible, or does it need to get more powerful, or what do you see happening there?
Yeah, it's not really more power. And like I said, I think that we managed to pull off everything you needed to do a long time ago. The more power is great, but I think it really comes down to the user experience and the user interface. I haven't seen the innovation there that I think needs to happen for it to become a more natural tool in the hand of the prosthetist or orthotist. I don't know exactly what that design is. I haven't been focusing on that, but It's one of those things, I think I'll know it when I see it and go, aha, yeah, they got that figured out, but I haven't seen it yet. And I think it's the user interface.
The other thing that I'm kind of curious on and wanting to get your take on, you know, you talk about the, you know, whether it's more powerful or not. I completely agree with you on user interface. The one thing that I find, and it's more because just we're an interesting group of people, is this idea of who owns the data, right? The data being, how do you modify? How are you successful? And there are some companies that try to do this cloud-based, and they're, you know, some machine learning across all of the data that comes through. And so you really lose control of some of your data, or your data actually might be helping somebody else create an awesome product. I just wanted to kind of get your thoughts about that.
Yeah. You know, I question a little bit about data without context. And, you know, when we think of whatever particular modification we're doing for a given patient, or how we're adjusting the socket shape for their loading, a lot of it has to do with exactly how the surgery was done, how much muscle was left when they did the myodesis, how much damage was done to the bone, was it carefully filed or was it left sharp? You know, there's a surgeon in between the original anatomy and the prosthetist. And that surgeon or that trauma is hugely variable. And so the prosthetist is always adjusting for that, not only the uniqueness of the patient, but the uniqueness of how the surgical procedure was done. So it's very hard to average that out, to build a machine learning that's not taking into account the information that the prosthetist is using in that design. Like I said, to me, it's data without context. It's a shape, and it's a number, and it's a measurement without really realizing why that contour had to be that way. Now, with a greater description, more, you know, fulsome description of what the process was dealing with and why, you can understand it, but I haven't seen that either. I've seen very simple geometric morphing and say, well, okay, well, here's the average limb. That gets back to the very, very origins of digital prosthetics and orthotics. You know, it all started in like 1964 or thereabouts. And Ampex, the company, you know, had just made a breakthrough in data density and how cheap they could make computer tape, magnetic tape. And Jim Ford and Colin McLaurin and people were corresponding about, well, gosh, I can put hundreds of thousands of measurements on one tape and use a machine to calculate averages. So they thought it would be a fairly straightforward thing to create a library of shapes that correspond to the universe. And that was where the University of British Columbia Medical Engineering Resource Unit started, Carl Saunders and the whole group that became CanFit and then Borum started on this idea of, you know, we can have this library of shapes from, you know, thousands of measurements that a computer has parsed for us. But it turns out that you could create a shape that is about the right volume and about the right size, but it always kind of looked like the computer shape and not like the individual patient. And that led to sort of that schism with the group in London, who said, you know, why don't we just start with the individual limb shape, digitize that, and then modify from there. And then you have the whole shape rectification of the CASD, or the computer-aided socket design group, who, you know, overlaid this set of modifications on a digital representation of the actual patient's limb. We took kind of that another step with ShapeMaker, and And so to me, when we talk about machine learning and large data sets and cloud basing your measurements, it's actually going back to that original kind of concept that, well, there's a mathematical representation of everybody. If we take everybody's measurements, well, but there are specific changes made for individuals that doesn't take into account. So I question it from that standpoint.
I think that's a really interesting observation. I think that's really cool. But I want to jump into something completely different, but you touched on it. and that's the one thing I'd like about the surgery being variable. Do we need to educate surgeons more, especially in traumatology and stuff, on, you know, what the best outcome for the patient is with regards to the surgery, if a leg that needs to be amputated and things like that? Is it, because it doesn't absolutely seem like there's a two-way street, you know?
Absolutely. Unfortunately, because the limb doesn't survive in an amputation, amputation surgery has been relegated to overwhelmingly to young surgeons to practice. They practice their bone cutting, their muscle folding, their sewing technique. Oftentimes at the end of the day, in the middle of the night, it's a resident orthopedic surgeon or general surgeon who's given this assignment to do the amputation. And it's such a waste and such a crime, because amputation surgery shouldn't be wastebasket surgery where it's a throwaway. Yeah, the limb's not going to live anyway, so just get us a clean suture line. Now, really, we should be educating surgeons better that it is reconstructive surgery. If you're amputating a transtibial at a transtibial level, that surgeon is creating the end effector, the foot that's going to carry the load, and it's going to help a person walk for the rest of their life. It's not as a mentor of mine used to say, one of the great orthopedic surgeons and amputations of all time is Ernie Burgess. And Ernie used to say, it's not difficult surgery, but it's precise. If you want a really good outcome, the surgery has to be done really, really well. Well, unfortunately, economics also plays into this. An orthopedic surgeon who you'd like to do this because of the skills required of dealing with the bone is probably going to make $1,200 for the surgery. And they could go and do a much easier hip implant and make $6,000. So there's economics, right, that's going to drive this. For many years, I used to go to the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgery, and they would have at their annual meeting teaching courses in amputation. And those used to be attended by 20 or 30 surgeons out of 20,000 at the meeting. And boy, I think recently you're lucky probably if you're getting 10 showing up for how to do amputation surgery correctly. There are a few surgeons who have, you know, taken up that the mantle of the older surgeons, many of whom who learned in wartime and were dealing with large numbers of young, healthy men. They wanted to be, you know, functional. But sadly, it's hugely variable still, and we need to train people better. As an example, I talked about Ernie Burgess. In the Pacific Theater in World War II, he did 3,500 amputations in 2 years. Well, you get really, really good at it. You know, you do anything that much. And like I said, these were young, otherwise healthy men who were traumatized by war. And you think about that they're going to have to go home and get a job and support a family. And it's not time to give it short shrift. It's really time to do your best job.
Thank you for that, because I just think it has such an impact on the person's rest of their life as well. So it should really be given more attention. But I think it's just out. It seems like kind of out of scope. Like, well, yeah, kind of like what these rehab people do with like the these two like those there's wooden bars and like, let's get them to walk again. It's like not our thing, you know?
Right, exactly. There's no thought that you are creating the conditions for that person to walk again.
Yeah, I think that needs to be a lot more awareness. I'm glad you're at least trying to do this. And that's really good. Also, it reminds me of the story of this guy, that Robert Liston, who was in the, I think it was in the 1800s or something. He was doing amputations as well. He tried to do one in 2.5 minutes. And he killed the patient, and he accidentally amputated his assistant's hands and killed the assistant. And then a witness died of shock watching it. So then theoretically, it has a 300% mortality rate on an amputation. So it's probably one of the worst cases of this kind of phenomenon. But yeah, it is seen like as a speedy kind of thing and something that. And I think it's a shame. I think it really is a shame. But I think an additive, we could really come a long way in rectifying a lot of this stuff as well. But with osseointegration, you mentioned these osseointegrative processes, is it even more important? How we cut the bone and how we leave it and that kind of thing, or not really?
It is. It is. The danger, of course, with any thing that protrudes from the skin is that there are very few tissues in the body that are designed for that. And certainly the tissues of the leg and the arm weren't. The ones that really are the gums in the mouth are very well adapted to fighting off infection, even though you have teeth sticking out through them. But the skin itself around the leg or the arm is not greatly adapted. So a lot of care has to be taken with how those tissues are handled. Now, it's come a long way in becoming safer and becoming something that can be done in kind of a routine way, you might say. It's been codified how to handle the soft tissue around the osseointegrated implant. But we are fighting a battle where the soft tissue isn't happy about it, and it never will be. And so there's this constant sort of low-grade infection, low-grade... irritation of the implant through the skin, and that hasn't been completely solved yet. It's just we keep it down to a minimum so that a person can live that way long term successfully. It's not ideal though.
Okay. Hey, so if we're looking at CAD and all that kind of stuff, what about 3D printing? What do you think of 3D printing additive? What's your opinion? Is it going to be change everything, or is it just going to be, it's a tool in the toolbox, like carbon fibers, or just something?
Yeah, so as a direct replacement, it's a tool in the toolbox. But from what Brent was talking about there, about leaving the lattice open as a flexible structure, leaving it so it's a breathable structure. So you're starting to use the capabilities of designing really complex structures on top of the shape. That, I think, is the opportunity for doing something much better than we've had before. Using additive manufacturing to make it in ways that traditional processes really fail at. I mean, you think about like a prosthetic socket that was thermoset resin, and we used to drill holes in it so that they would breathe. How crude is that in comparison to designing a structure or a lattice structure that can support but also be flexible and in variable amounts in different areas? So it's getting to that more advanced sort of parametric design. What do we want the prosthesis to do? Where do we want it stiff? Where do we want it soft? Where do we want it breathable? Where do we want it super flexible, so we're not pinching when we're trying to maintain range of motion? That's when it gets really exciting, that this holds the promise for doing prosthetics or orthotics better than we've ever done before.
Yeah, on that, you know, with the 3D printing and even the CAD side of things, I know you said you'd see the perfect solution when you would know the perfect solution when you saw it. What are some of the ingredients that you see as part of that solution? I've seen, and you've seen it too. You know, a lot of these programs kind of come and go, and it just seems like we can't get everybody into the sandbox listening to each other to grow the right program, right? And there's always, right. And everybody's got to make money along the way somehow. But we have more options now than ever before, and it seems like we're not any closer on finding something that is actually a standard across our field.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, one way I think to get there is we have to refocus what our goal is. I think that if the goal of, say, someone working on software and somebody working on the manufacturing technique, and if the goal is totally focused on the function of the patient, such that we are eliminating the barriers to function, we are creating the opportunities for function, but we're focused on patient function at every step of the way, then that sort of, to me, pulls away the limiting factors of, oh, that's not the way I make a socket, or that's not the way I design the shape. Who cares? If I can prove to you that the patient function is optimized, how you do it doesn't matter. What it's made of doesn't matter. You know, I think one of the key lessons for every young prosthetist orthotist is that your job is not at all about the thing you make. It's not at all about how you make it. It's about restoring patient function. And that, I think, is where the emphasis has to be to get to that sort of ultimate combination of hardware and software and technique and material. And it's all got to be about the patient's end function. And if we see opportunities for improving that function, and we see opportunities for enhancing that function, and we just throw everything we care about, you know, we know how to do, out the window, and we say, but this is the better way, then I think we'll get to something that revolutionizes the field. But I mean, that my feeling is it's got to be a philosophical stand that it's not about what we make, how we make it. It's got to be about the patient function.
I think that's a wonderful idea to, like, just increase the utility of the patient, make their lives or more successful or less painful, that kind of thing. It's a wonderful sentiment. It also kind of keeps you grounded, I guess, because but at the same time, it seems like a very titanic undertaking than if you're trying to, if you put so much stress on yourself all the time.
but that's what every prosthetist or orthotist should be doing every day, right? You're trying to do everything you can for that individual, and not just to reproduce what you've done before, right? It's always, what can I do that's going to help this person in the way they need it? And so, I don't know, that to me is the job.
Okay. And how do you see the job? Because we keep talking here about the market and how things are evolving. And how do you see the job evolving? Do you think it's going to be, you know, because one hand we could just say, oh, it's going to be these small shops, you know, functioning as they were before, just newer tools. But we're seeing a lot of consolidation in the industry. We're seeing problems with, like, we're seeing startups that kind of try to bypass orthotists and prosthetists. We're seeing a lot of movement compared to before, I think. How do you see the future of the industry?
I see it as almost more of a gig economy for young prosthetists or orthotists. You know, it used to be that people would want to set up practice, put out their shingle, work with somebody good in a clinic and stay there for a decade or two or three or four, you know, and you stick with that. Partially you stick with it because those clients were yours for life. You know, if you had somebody that you had treated well and you made a prosthesis or orthosis for, you saw that person every year or two for the rest of their life. So, you know, that kept you in kind of a, I think, it's kind of a static thing. But what I see going on now is very different. I see young prosthetist orthotists who are not wedded to where they're working or even who they're working with so much. There's been a lot of consolidation and larger companies owning practices. So young prosthetist orthotists are becoming more freelance, more able to move. You know, that's having a really profound change. We think of P&O as being small business owners. And instead, I think we've become more, or what I've seen is young prosthetist orthotists are becoming contractors, you know, kind of out for hire. And moving in and out of positions and not really setting up business on their own the same way. Now, we could flip that on its head and say then everybody's their own boss, but I haven't seen that happen yet. So maybe we're just in that transition period. It's a really challenging transition for our associations like AOPA, which is really based on individuals owning practices. Well, there are far fewer owners now, even though we have more practitioners. But all those practitioners don't join AOPA, the businesses do. I think it's hard on the academy because, you know, people are moving in, I can say, almost as contractors, and they have to kind of do things the way they're told where they get to. Big companies are doing their own training, their own meetings. And so it's less about the individual excelling than before. So those are some of the trends I see.
Okay. That's, I think one interesting thing I've noticed is this is a business where a lot of people invent a lot of things, right? You can just invent, just like what Brent was telling about, like flipping the lattice there. And you've invented an awful lot of stuff, I think. So mm-hmm. How do you invent something? If I'm not into, because I, you know, it's a weird question. If we work in an ice cream parlor, it's a weird question. Like, how do we invent something? But I think as an orthotist and prosthetist, I think it would be very beneficial to invent new things, like maybe not every day, but quite regularly.
Yeah, I mean, that we're dealing with this incredible human machine that has had millions of years to evolve into something super efficient and functional. And then when we have an amputation or we have a disability that needs an orthosis, all of that evolution is, you know, it's not available basically to achieve the task. And our lives, our businesses, our automobiles, everything we use is all designed around how the human body has evolved. And so we're trying to accommodate that. We're trying to fit that person in to how the rest of the world has evolved around a healthy body. So I think that the inventiveness comes from the fact that we just have a small percentage of those functions and efficiencies that we can return. And we're constantly striving to increase that percentage of return. Again, getting back to, it's all about patient function. And if you buy into that, and it doesn't matter how you made a prosthesis last week, and it doesn't matter how a knee functioned last year or what I'm used to, then it's quite easy to start thinking fresh about what does this patient need? How can I get to a solution that's going to help them the most? And because we've just barely scratched the surface of the capabilities of the human body, we we have lots and lots of opportunities for inventiveness.
Okay. Well, I love this. Thank you, David. This is absolutely fantastic. How about you, Brent?
Oh, this was great. It was great to hear kind of the journey and insights along the way. And I actually wrote something down. Restoring patient function. You know, everything revolves around that as a vendor, as a clinician, as a researcher. If you keep that in the forefront as your vision or your mantra, I think you're going to be successful.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I agree. That's your guiding star.
Well, that's good. Thanks for this insight, gentlemen. This is absolutely fantastic. And thank you for listening, everybody. And a really wonderful, really well-fitting 50th episode. And hope you enjoy the show and do spread the word.